Hello and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a feature article by Gertz et al. Immunocompromise-associated pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, experience from the 2016-2017 pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome incidence and epidemiology prospective cohort study. Objectives: to characterize immunocompromise-associated pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, or IPARDS, and contrast it to pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, or PARDS. Design: this is a secondary analysis of the 2016-2017 PARDS Incidence and Epidemiology, or PARDI, study, a prospective observational cross-sectional study of children with PARDS. Setting: data set of 145 PICUs across 27 countries. Patients: during 10 non-consecutive weeks from May 2016 to June 2017, data about immunocompromising conditions, defined as malignancy, congenital or acquired immunodeficiency, post-transplantation, or diseases requiring immunosuppression, were collected. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: of 708 subjects, 105, or 14.8%, had immunocompromising conditions. Before the development of IPARDS, those with immunocompromising conditions were more likely to be hospitalized, 70% versus 35% and a p-value less than 0.001, be more at risk for PARDS, p-value equal to 0.046, and spend more hours at risk, 20 hours with an interquartile range of 8 to 46 hours versus 11 hours with an interquartile range of 4 to 33 hours and a p-value equal to 0.002. Non-invasive ventilation use was more common in those with immunocompromising conditions, with a p-value less than 0.001. Of 161 diagnosed with PARDS on non-invasive ventilation, children with immunocompromising conditions were more likely to be subsequently intubated, with an N equal to 28 of 40 or 70%, versus an N of 53 of 121 or 44%, and a p-value equal to 0.004. Severe PARDS was more common in IPARDS, 32% versus 23%, with a p-value less than 0.001. Oxygenation indices were higher at diagnosis and had less improvement over the first 3 days of PARDS, with a p-value less than 0.001. Children with IPARDS had greater non-pulmonary organ dysfunction. Adjusting for pediatric risk of mortality 4 and oxygenation index, children with IPARDS had a higher severity of illness-adjusted PICU mortality, with an adjusted hazard ratio of 3, a 95% confidence interval of 1.9 to 4.7, and a p-value less than 0.001, and they were less likely to be extubated alive within 28 days, with a subdistribution hazard ratio of 0.47, a 95% confidence interval of 0.31 to 0.71, and a p-value less than 0.001. Conclusions: IPARDS is a unique subtype of PARDS associated with hospitalization before diagnosis, an increased time at risk for PARDS, non-invasive ventilation use, hypoxia, non-pulmonary organ dysfunction, and mortality. The opportunity for early detection and intervention seems to exist. Dedicated study in these patients is imperative to determine if targeted interventions will benefit these unique patients with the ultimate goal of improving outcomes. Abstract 2 is a feature article by Siegel et al., Formal Ethics Consultation in Extracorporeal Membrane Oxygenation Patients, a single-center retrospective cohort of a quaternary pediatric hospital. Objectives: to examine characteristics associated with formal ethics consultation referral in pediatric extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, cases, and document ethical issues presented. Design: retrospective cohort study using mixed methods. Setting: single-center quaternary pediatric hospital. Patients: patients supported on ECMO from January 2012 to December 2021. Interventions: we compared clinical variables among ECMO patients according to the presence of ethics consultation. We defined optimal cutoffs for ethics consultation based on run duration, ICU length of stay, and sum of procedures or complications. To identify independent explanatory variables for ethics consultation, we used a forward stepwise selection multivariable logistic regression model. Ethics consultation records were thematically characterized into ethical issues. Measurements and main results: Of 601 ECMO patients and 225 patients with ethics consultation in 10 years, 27 ECMO patients received ethics consultation, or 4.5% of ECMO patients and 12% of all ethics consultations. On univariate analysis, use of ethics consultation versus not was associated with multiple ECMO runs, more complications and procedures, longer ICU length of stay and ECMO duration, cardiac admissions, decannulation outcome, and higher mortality. Cutoffs for ethics consultation were ICU length of stay over 52 days, run duration over 160 hours, and over 6 complications and procedures. Independent associations with ethics consultation included these 3 cutoffs and older age. The model showed good discrimination and fit, with an area under the curve 0.88 with a range of 0.83 to 0.93. The most common primary ethical issues were related to end of life, ECMO discontinuation, and treatment decision making. Moral distress was cited in 22 of 27 cases, or 82%. Conclusion: ethics consultation was used in 4.5% of our pediatric ECMO cases, with most ethical issues related to end of life care or ECMO discontinuation. Older age, longer ICU length of stay, prolonged runs, and multiple procedures and/or complications were associated with greater odds for ethics consultation requests. These data highlight our single-center experience of ECMO-associated ethical dilemmas. Historical referral patterns may guide a supported decision-making framework. Future work will need to include quality improvement projects for timely ethics consultation with evaluation of impacts on relevant endpoints. Abstract 3 is a feature article by Yates et al. Early cardiac arrest hemodynamics, end-tidal CO2, and outcome in pediatric extracorporeal cardiopulmonary resuscitation, secondary analysis of the ICU resuscitation project data set from 2016 to 2021. Objectives: cannulation for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation during active extracorporeal cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or ECPR, is a method to rescue patients refractory to standard resuscitation. We hypothesized that early arrest hemodynamics and end-tidal CO2 are associated with survival to hospital discharge with favorable neurologic outcome in pediatric ECPR patients. Design: pre-planned secondary analysis of pediatric Utsine hemodynamic and ventilatory data in ECPR patients collected during the 2016 to 2021 Improving Outcomes from Pediatric Cardiac Arrest Study, the ICU Resuscitation Project. Setting: 18 ICUs participated in ICU resus. Patients: there were 97 ECPR patients with hemodynamic waveforms during cardiopulmonary resuscitation. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Overall, 71 of 97 patients, or 73%, were younger than 1 year old, 82 of 97, or 85%, had congenital heart disease, and 62 of 97, or 64%, were postoperative cardiac surgical patients. 40 of 97 patients, or 41%, survived with favorable neurologic outcome. We failed to find differences in diastolic or systolic blood pressure, proportion achieving age-based target diastolic or systolic blood pressure, or chest compression rate during the initial 10 minutes of CPR between patients who survived with favorable neurologic outcome and those who did not. 35 patients had end-tidal CO2 data. Of 17 survivors with favorable neurologic outcome, 4 of 17, or 24%, had an average end-tidal CO2 less than 10 millimeters of mercury, and 2, or 12%, had a maximum end-tidal CO2 less than 10 millimeters of mercury during the initial 10 minutes of resuscitation. Conclusions: we did not identify an association between early hemodynamics achieved by high-quality CPR and survival to hospital discharge with favorable neurologic outcome after pediatric ECPR. Candidates for ECPR with end-tidal CO2 less than 10 millimeters of mercury may survive with favorable neurologic outcome. Abstract 4 is a feature article by McCrory et al. Child Opportunity Index and Pediatric Intensive Care Outcomes, a multicenter retrospective study in the United States. Objectives: to evaluate for associations between a child's neighborhood as categorized by Child Opportunity Index and 1. PICU mortality, 2. Severity of illness at PICU admission, and 3. PICU length of stay. Design: retrospective cohort study. Setting, 15 PICUs in the United States. Patients, children younger than 18 years admitted from 2019 to 2020, excluding those after cardiac procedures. Nationally normed Child Opportunity Index category, including very low, low, moderate, high, or very high, was determined for each admission by census tract, and clinical features were obtained from the Virtual Pediatric Systems LLC data from each site. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Among 33,901 index PICU admissions during the time period, median patient age was 4.9 years, and PICU mortality was 2.1%. There was a higher percentage of admissions from the very low Child Opportunity Index category at 27.3% than other Child Opportunity Index categories, with a range of 17.2% to 19.5% and a p-value less than 0.0001. Patient admissions from the high and very high Child Opportunity Index categories had a lower median pediatric index of mortality 3 risk of mortality of 0.7 than those from the very low, low, and moderate Child Opportunity Index groups, with a median of 0.71 and a p-value less than 0.001. PICU mortality was lowest in the very high and high Child Opportunity Index groups at 1.7 and 1.9% respectively, and highest in the moderate group at 2.5%, followed by very low at 2.3% and low at 2.2%, with a p-value equal to 0.001 across categories. Median PICU length of stay was between 1.37 and 1.5 days in all Child Opportunity Index categories. Multivariable regression revealed adjusted odds of PICU mortality of 1.3 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.94 to 1.79 and a p-value equal to 0.11 for children from a very low versus very high Child Opportunity Index neighborhood, with an odds ratio of 0.996, a 95% confidence interval of 0.993 to 1, and a p-value equal to 0.05 for mortality for Child Opportunity Index as an ordinal value from 0 to 100. Children without insurance coverage had an odds ratio for mortality of 3.58 with a 95% confidence interval of 2.46 to 5.2 and a p-value less than 0.0001 as compared with those without commercial insurance. Conclusions. Children admitted to a cohort of U.S. PICUs were often from very low Child Opportunity Index neighborhoods. Children from very high Child Opportunity Index had the lowest risk of mortality and observed mortality. However, odds of mortality were not statistically different by Child Opportunity Index category in a multivariable model. Children without insurance coverage had significantly higher odds of PICU mortality regardless of neighborhood. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation by Wilsterman et al., evaluating airway management in patients with trisomy 21 in the PICU and cardiac ICU, a retrospective cohort study. Objectives. Children with trisomy 21 often have anatomic and physiologic features that may complicate tracheal intubation. Tracheal intubation in critically ill children with trisomy 21 is not well described. We hypothesize that in children with trisomy 21, tracheal intubation is associated with greater odds of adverse airway outcomes, including tracheal intubation-associated events and peri-intubation hypoxemia, defined as greater than 20% decrease in pulse oximetry saturation, or SpO2. Design. Retrospective database study using the National Emergency Airway Registry for Children, or NEAR for Kids. Setting. Registry data from 16 North American PICUs and cardiac ICUs, or CICUs, from January 2014 to December 2020. Patients. A cohort of children under 18 years old who underwent tracheal intubation in the PICU or CICU from a NEAR for Kids center. We identified patients with trisomy 21 and selected matched cohorts within the registry. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We included 8,401 tracheal intubations in the registry dataset. Children with trisomy 21 accounted for 274, or 3.3%, of the tracheal intubations. Among those with trisomy 21, 84% had congenital heart disease and 4% had atlantoaxial instability. Cervical spine protection was used in 6%. The diagnosis of trisomy 21 versus without was associated with lower median weight of 7.8 kilograms with an interquartile range of 4.5 to 14.7 kilograms versus 10.6 kilograms with an interquartile range of 5.2 to 25 kilograms with a p-value less than 0.001, and a higher percentage of children with trisomy 21 underwent tracheal intubation for oxygenation and ventilation failure. The percentage of children with trisomy 21 undergoing tracheal intubation for oxygenation versus without was 46% versus 32% with a p-value less than 0.001, and the percentage of children with trisomy 21 undergoing tracheal intubation for ventilation failure was 41% versus 35% with a p-value equal to 0.04. Patients with trisomy 21 had more difficult airway features, 35% versus 25%, with a p-value equal to 0.001, including upper airway obstruction, 14% versus 8%, and a p-value equal to 0.001. In addition, a greater percentage of patients with trisomy 21 received atropine, 34% versus 26%, with a p-value equal to 0.004, and a lower percentage were intubated with video laryngoscopy, 30% versus 37%, with a p-value equal to 0.023. After 1 to 10 propensity score matching, trisomy 21 to controls, we failed to identify an association difference in adverse airway outcome rates with an absolute risk difference of negative 0.6%, a 95% confidence interval of negative 6.1 to 4.9, and a p-value equal to 0.822. Conclusions. Despite differences in airway risks and tracheal intubation approaches, we have not identified an association between the diagnosis of trisomy 21 and higher adverse airway outcomes. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation by DuPont Thibodeau et al. Iron deficiency in anemic children surviving critical illness, post hoc analysis of a single center prospective cohort in Canada from 2019 to 2022. Objectives. Many children leave the PICU with anemia. The mechanisms of post-PICU anemia are poorly investigated, and treatment of anemia other than blood is rarely started during PICU admission. We aim to characterize the contributions of iron depletion and/or inflammation in the development of post-PICU anemia and to explore the utility of hepcidin, a novel iron marker at detecting iron depletion during inflammation. Design. Post-hoc analysis of a single-center prospective study from November 2019 to September 2022. Setting. A PICU in a quaternary center in Canada. Patients. Children admitted to the PICU with greater than or equal to 48 hours of invasive or greater than or equal to 96 hours of non-invasive ventilation. We excluded patients with pre-existing conditions causing anemia or those admitted after cardiac surgery. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Hematological and iron profiles were performed at PICU discharge on 56 participants, of which 37 were diagnosed with anemia. 33 children, or 59%, were younger than 2 years. Median pediatric logistic organ dysfunction score was 11, with an interquartile range of 6 to 16. 24 of the 37 anemic patients had repeat blood work 2 months post-PICU. Of those, 4 of 24, or 16%, remained anemic. Hematologic profiles were categorized as anemia of inflammation, iron deficiency anemia with inflammation, and iron deficiency with low iron stores without anemia. 7 of 47, or 15%, had anemia of inflammation at discharge, and 1 had persistent anemia of inflammation post-PICU. 3 patients of 47, or 6%, had iron deficiency anemia at discharge, of which 1 was lost to follow-up and the other 2 were no longer anemic but had iron deficiency with low iron stores post-PICU. 11 additional patients developed iron deficiency with low iron stores post-PICU. In the exploratory analysis, we identified a diagnostic cutoff value for iron deficiency during inflammation from the receiver operating characteristic curve for hepcidin of 31.9 picograms per milliliter. This cutoff would increase the detection of iron deficiency at discharge from 6% to 34%. Conclusions. The burden of iron deficiency in children post-PICU is high, and better management strategies are required. Hepcidin may increase the diagnostic yield of iron deficiency in patients with inflammation. Abstract 7 is a brief report by McCabe et al. Admission functional status is associated with intensivist perception of extracorporeal membrane oxygenation candidacy for pediatric acute respiratory failure. Objectives. to determine the association between admission functional status scale category and perceived extracorporeal membrane oxygenation or ECMO candidacy for pediatric acute respiratory failure. Design: prospective cross-sectional study. Setting: single-center quaternary and ECMO referral academic children's hospital between March 2021 and January 2022. Subjects: pediatric intensivists directly caring for patients admitted with acute respiratory failure secondary to shock or respiratory disease. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Pediatric intensivists were surveyed about current patients within 72 hours of initiation or escalation of invasive mechanical ventilation on whether they would offer ECMO should their patient deteriorate. Baseline functional status was assessed using trichotomized admission functional status scale. 1. Normal or mild dysfunction with a score of 6 to 9, 2. Moderate dysfunction with a score of 10 to 15, and 3. Severe dysfunction with a score greater than 16. Multivariable logistic regression clustered by physician was used to assess the association between admission functional status scale category with perceived ECMO candidacy. 37 intensivists participated with 76% or 137 of 180 survey responses by those with less than 10 years of experience. 81% of patients or 146 of 180 were perceived as ECMO candidates, and 19% of patients or 34 of 180 were non-candidates. Non-candidates had worse admission functional status scale scores than candidates, 15.5 versus 9, with a p-value less than 0.001. After adjustment for age, admission functional status scale category of severe dysfunction had lower odds of perceived ECMO candidacy compared with normal to mild dysfunction, with an odds ratio of 0.18, a 95% confidence interval of 0.06 to 0.56, and a p-value less than 0.003. Patients with an abnormal communication subscore domain had the lowest odds of being considered a candidate, with an unadjusted odds ratio of 0.44, a 95% confidence interval of 0.29 to 0.68, and a p-value less than 0.0001. Conclusions. In this prospective single-center cross-sectional study, admission functional status scale category indicating worse baseline functional status impacted pediatric intensivist perception of ECMO candidacy for patients with acute respiratory failure. Abnormal functional status scale subscores in the neurocognitive domains were the most important considerations. Future studies should better seek to define the decision-making priorities of both parents and medical specialists for the utilization of ECMO in children with acute respiratory failure. Abstract 8 is a special article by Hennigan et al., the Pediatric Data Science and Analytics Subgroup of the Pediatric Acute Lung Injury and Sepsis Investigators Network, Use of Supervised Machine Learning Applications in Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Research. Objective: perform a scoping review of supervised machine learning in pediatric critical care to identify published applications, methodologies, and implement frequency to inform best practices for the development, validation, and reporting of predictive models in pediatric critical care. Design: scoping review and expert opinion. Setting: we queried CINAHL Plus with full text, EBSCO, Cochrane Library, Wiley, Embase, Elsevier, Ovid Medline, and PubMed for articles published between 2000 and 2022 related to machine learning concepts and pediatric critical illness. Articles were excluded if the majority of patients were adults or neonates, if unsupervised machine learning was the primary methodology, or if information related to the development, validation, and/or implementation of the model was not reported. Article selection and data extraction were performed using dual review in the Covidence tool, with discrepancies resolved by consensus. Subjects: articles reporting on the development, validation, or implementation of supervised machine learning models in the field of pediatric critical care medicine. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Of 5,075 identified studies, 141 articles were included. Studies were primarily performed at a single site, 57%. The majority, or 70%, took place in the United States. Most were retrospective observational cohort studies. More than three-quarters of the articles were published between 2018 and 2022. The most common algorithms included logistic regression and random forest. Predicted events were most commonly death, transfer to ICU, and sepsis. Only 14% of articles reported external validation, and only a single model was implemented at publication. reporting of validation methods, performance assessments, and implementation varied widely. Follow-up with authors suggests that implementation remains uncommon after model publication. Conclusions. Publication of supervised machine learning models to address clinical challenges in pediatric critical care medicine has increased dramatically in the last 5 years. While these approaches have the potential to benefit children with critical illness, the literature demonstrates incomplete reporting, absence of external validation, and infrequent clinical implementation. Abstract 9 is an online clinical investigation by Thonbo et al. Pediatric profound dengue shock syndrome and use of point-of-care ultrasound during mechanical ventilation to guide treatment. Single-center retrospective study 2013 to 2021. Objectives. Profound dengue shock syndrome complicated by severe respiratory failure necessitating mechanical ventilation accounts for high case fatality rates among PICU-admitted patients. A major challenge to management is the assessment of intravascular volume, which can be hampered by severe plasma leakage and the use of mechanical ventilation. Design, retrospective cohort from 2013 to 2021. Patients included 67 children with profound dengue shock syndrome supported by mechanical ventilation, some of whom underwent bedside point-of-care ultrasound for assessment and monitoring of hemodynamics and fluid administration. Setting, PICU of the Tertiary Children's Hospital No. 2 in Vietnam. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We analyzed clinical and laboratory data during PICU stay. In particular, during fluid resuscitation and use of mechanical ventilation at 0, 6, and 24 hours after commencement. The primary study outcome was 28-day in-hospital mortality, and the secondary outcomes were associations with changes in hemodynamics, blood lactate, and vasoactive inotrope score. Patients had a median age of 7 years with an interquartile range of 4 to 9 years. Use of point-of-care ultrasound during fluid management as opposed to not using point-of-care ultrasound during fluid management was associated with lower mortality. Point-of-care ultrasound during fluid management occurred in 39 of 67 cases with a mortality rate of 6 of 39 or 15%, while 28 of 67 cases did not have point-of-care ultrasound during fluid management and a mortality rate was 18 of 28 or 64%. The difference was 49% with a 95% confidence interval of 28 to 70% and a p-value less than 0.001. Use of point-of-care ultrasound was associated with lower odds of death with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.17, a 95% confidence interval of 0.04 to 0.76, and a p-value equal to 0.02. The utilization of point-of-care ultrasound versus not was associated with greater use of resuscitation fluid and reductions in vasoactive inotropic score and pediatric logistic organ dysfunction or PLOD2 score at 24 hours after mechanical ventilation and PICU discharge. Conclusions. In our experience of pediatric patients with profound dengue shock syndrome and undergoing mechanical ventilation, point-of-care ultrasound use was associated with lower odds of death, a higher volume of resuscitation fluid, and improvements in the blood lactate levels, vasoactive inotropic score, and PLOD2 score. Abstract 10 is an online clinical investigation by Sanker et al. Pediatric sepsis phenotypes and outcome, 5-year retrospective cohort study in a single center in India from 2017 to 2022. Objectives, to describe mortality associated with different clinical phenotypes of sepsis in children. Design, retrospective study. Setting, PICU of a tertiary care center in India from 2017 to 2022. Patients included 612 children from 2 months to 17 years old with a retrospectively applied diagnosis of sepsis using 2020 guidance. Methods. The main outcome was mortality associated with sepsis subtypes. Other analyses included assessment of risk factors, requirement for organ support, and PICU resources used by sepsis phenotype. Clinical data were recorded on a pre-designed performa. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Of the 612 children identified, there were 382 or 62% with sepsis but no multiple organ failure, 48 or 8% with thrombocytopenia associated multiple organ failure, 140 or 23% with multiple organ failure without thrombocytopenia, and 40 or 6.5% with sequential multiple organ failure. Mortality was higher in the sequential multiple organ failure group in 20 of 40 or 50%, multiple organ failure group, 62 of 140 or 44%, and thrombocytopenia associated multiple organ failure group, 20 of 48 or 42%, compared with the no multiple organ failure group, 82 of 382 or 21%, and a p-value less than 0.001. The requirement for organ support and PICU resources was higher in all phenotypes with multiple organ failure as compared with those without multiple organ failure. On multivariable analysis, elevated lactate and having multiple organ failure were associated with greater odds of mortality. Conclusions. In this single center experience of sepsis in India, we found that sepsis phenotypes having multiple organ failure were associated with mortality and the requirement of PICU resources. Prospective studies in different regions of the world will help identify a classification of pediatric sepsis that is more widely applicable. Abstract 11 is an online PCCM Perspective Professional Organization Material article by Jackson et al. Sedation Research in Critically Ill Pediatric Patients, Proposals for Future Study Design from the Sedation Consortium on Endpoints and Procedures for Treatment, Education, and Research for Workshop. Objectives. Sedation and analgesia for infants and children requiring mechanical ventilation in the PICU is uniquely challenging due to the wide spectrum of ages, developmental stages, and pathophysiological processes encountered. Studies evaluating the safety and efficacy of sedative and analgesic management in pediatric patients have used heterogeneous methodologies. The Sedation Consortium on Endpoints and Procedures for Treatment, Education, and Research, or SEPTER 4, hosted a series of multidisciplinary meetings to establish consensus statements for future clinical study design and implementation as a guide for investigators studying PICU sedation and analgesia. Design. 25 key elements framed as consensus statements were developed in 5 domains: study design, enrollment, protocol, outcomes and measurement instruments, and future directions. Setting. A virtual meeting was held March 2nd and 3rd, 2022, followed by an in-person meeting in Washington, D.C. on June 15th and 16th, 2022. Subsequent iterative online meetings were held to achieve consensus. Subjects. 51 multidisciplinary international participants from academia, industry, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and family members of PICU patients attended the virtual and in-person meetings. Participants were invited based on their background and experience. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Common themes throughout the SEPTER 4 consensus statements included using coordinated multidisciplinary and interprofessional teams to ensure culturally appropriate study design and diverse patient enrollment, obtaining input from PICU survivors and their families, engaging community members, and using developmentally appropriate and validated instruments for assessments of sedation, pain, iatrogenic withdrawal, and ICU delirium. Conclusions. These SEPTER 4 consensus statements are comprehensive and may assist investigators in the design, enrollment, implementation, and dissemination of studies involving sedation and analgesia of PICU patients requiring mechanical ventilation. Implementation may strengthen the rigor and reproducibility of research studies on PICU sedation and analgesia and facilitate the synthesis of evidence across studies to improve the safety and quality of care for PICU patients. Abstract 12 is an online neurocritical care article by Nellis et al. Scenario decision-making about plasma and platelet transfusion for intracranial monitor placement, cross-sectional survey of pediatric intensivists and neurosurgeons. Objectives. To report pediatric intensivists and pediatric neurosurgeons' responses to case-based scenarios about plasma and platelet transfusion before intracranial pressure or ICP monitor placement in children with severe traumatic brain injury or TBI. Design. Cross-sectional electronic survey to evaluate reported plasma and platelet transfusion decisions in 8 scenarios of TBI in which ICP monitor placement was indicated. Setting. Survey administered through the Pediatric Acute Lung Injury and Sepsis Investigators and the American Association of Neurologic Surgeons. Subjects. Pediatric intensivists and pediatric neurosurgeons. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. A total of 184 participants responded, 85 identified as pediatric intensivists, and 54 as pediatric neurosurgeons. In all 8 scenarios, the majority of respondents reported that they would base their decision-making about plasma transfusion on international normalized ratio or INR alone in 60 to 69%, or platelet transfusion on platelet count alone, 83 to 86%. For the case-based scenarios, pediatric intensivists, as opposed to pediatric neurosurgeons, more frequently reported that they would have used viscoelastic testing in their consideration of plasma transfusion, 32% versus 7%, with a p-value less than 0.001, as well as to guide platelet transfusions, 29% versus 8%, with a p-value less than 0.001. For all relevant case-based scenarios, pediatric neurosurgeons in comparison with pediatric intensivists reported that they would use a lower median INR threshold for plasma transfusion, 1.5 with an interquartile range of 1.4 to 1.7 versus 2 with an interquartile range of 1.5 to 2 and a p-value less than 0.001. Overall, in all respondents, the reported median platelet count threshold for platelet transfusion in the case-based scenario was 100 with no difference between specialties. Conclusions. Despite little evidence showing efficacy, when we tested specialist decision-making, we found that they reported using INR and platelet count in pediatric case-based scenarios of TBI undergoing ICP monitor placement. We also found that pediatric intensivists and pediatric neurosurgeons had differences in decision-making about the scenarios. The PCCM narrative this month is entitled Superhero by Tynan Friend. I stood against the hard, dirt-gray plastic bumper that lined the wall. My hands were at my lower back, in the position most medical students adopt when we know we should be present but don't know what to say or do. Two interns stood beside me, each flanked by residents, nurses, social workers, chaplains, a few attendings. All were in the same position, and all were nearly silent. It was approaching 4:30 p.m. on a Friday, my first of the pediatrics rotation, but it felt closer to 1 a.m. because of the dimmed lights and hushed atmosphere. All but one of the patient rooms in the PICU were shut, and through the single open door, the line of people along the short hallway, maybe 20, maybe 30, could hear the quiet conversation taking place inside. This conversation, and the events to follow, had been planned days in advance with coordination from individuals across the country. Between sniffles, stifled cries, and the sharp but soft pulsed drone of the heart monitor, I could make out just enough of what the surgeons in the room were saying. We're almost ready. Grace, a healthy 4-year-old girl, drowned in a lake the day before I met her. Although her body had since been kept functioning by an endless array of tubes and pumps and medicines, she had lost brainstem function during the accident. She was pronounced dead on the first day of my second rotation of my third year of medical school. I had dealt with death in the hospital a few times before this. All patients had been older adults whom I did not know personally. All had been very ill for years prior, and all brought tears to my eyes. Grace's death was different. Shortly after I walked through the snow-white doors to the PICU that Monday, it was all but known to our team of an attending physician, a senior resident, two interns, a sub-intern, and eventually me, that Grace would not survive her injuries. At the conclusion of the brain death examination, I was sad, anxious, empty. My fingers tingled and my breath quickened. I wanted to run out of the room, out of the PICU, out of the hospital, to be far away from the piercing alarms of Grace's ventilator and the guttural wails of her parents. But as I watched my team provide comfort, as I saw the tears in my senior resident's puffy red eyes, as I heard deafening silence start to fall on the unit, I felt a change. I became focused and calm, driven and present. I later listened more intently on rounds than I ever had before. I watched with awe as Grace's mom and dad laid with her for hours on end, holding her teddy bear beside her slowly graying body. I studied and questioned the physiology, not only wanting, but needing to understand what was happening to her organs and why. In retrospect, maybe this shift was a result of my anxious mind needing to intellectualize, or maybe it was a subconscious attempt at an internal morbidity and mortality conference held to prevent this from ever happening again. But it was the most passionate and present I have ever felt about being in a particular place at a particular time with a particular group of people. The procurement of Grace's heart, liver, and kidneys was scheduled for Friday at 5 p.m. as I, a third-year medical student lacking knowledge and confidence and experience, stood silently along the wall of the PICU with my colleagues, I felt a sense of community. I felt like I belonged in this place, like my spotless blue scrubs and barely used stethoscope and clean pad of notepaper actually meant something to a patient and her family. I felt tears welling up in my eyes, like I had come to expect with experiencing the death of a patient, but this time they felt different. I was sad for Grace. I was sad for her parents. I was sad for her younger brother. I was sad for this horrific situation. But I was also proud of the work my team had done, and I was thankful to have been a small part of her care. I was grateful for the opportunity to learn how I react to my emotions in the face of devastation. I was thankful for the pediatrics and hospital teams who helped us all with tissues and hugs and meaningful debriefs. Most of all, I was grateful to be shown by my patient that my real passion and purpose in medicine lies in these most difficult moments. Grace was slowly wheeled down our small PICU hallway, led by transplant surgeons and anesthesiologists, stabilized by pediatric intensivists, and followed, teddy bear in hand, by her parents, her grandfather, and her brother. Once she turned the corner, many of us followed behind to see her final passage to the operating rooms. I peered, and down a hallway the length of an Olympic swimming pool stood what looked like hundreds of other doctors, nurses, students, technologists, therapists, and administrators paying their respects. Through the blur of my tears, the hallway faded into a sea of blue as professional attire and monogrammed gray fleeces transitioned into operating room scrubs. Halfway down, below twinkling lights, Grace and her family waited at the sterile threshold separating the PICU from the operating rooms. High on the wall above them hung a poster adorned with colorful scribbles and crayon. Grace's younger brother had drawn it as a gift. He was told by his parents that on this Friday at 5 p.m., his sister would become a real-life superhero. I was there when she did. An hour later, when the tears finally slowed, I called my parents on the walk home from the hospital. It was a beautiful summer day. "I don't know what I want to do in medicine," I remember saying. "If it's pediatrics or critical care or surgery or transplant or a mix of all this." I paused, exhaled, and thought about Grace and the 5 lives she saved, about her family and the ultimate sacrifice they made, and about my life and how lucky I am to do what I get to do. But I know I have to do that. This concludes the abstracts for the April issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.